This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with British filmmaker Deborah Perkin. She's in Baton Rouge for a production of her compelling work, Bastards. We'll talk with Deborah Perkin. Also on the show, Deborah Feldman. Her book is Exodus, a memoir, another profound work about her voyage from being an Orthodox Jew to moving in a different direction. And Susan Schillinglaw on Reading the Grapes of Wrath. It's the 75th anniversary of the classic novel. It won the Pulitzer Prize, written by Nobel Prize winner John Steinbeck. We'll converse with Susan Schillinglaw about The Grapes of Wrath 7.5 decades later. And we'll have much more. But first, the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Deborah Perkin. She has produced a compelling and profound film called Bastards. Well, the title is certainly one that brings attention. And tonight, as in this evening, at 6:30 at Louisiana State University at the Russell Geoscience Building, which is near the Union, Deborah Perkin's film will show, and we will get to know much more about her work, which has been celebrated across the globe. In fact, it will be at the Bird's Eye View Film Festival in London next month, and at a film festival, an international one in Morocco in April as well, and then the New York African Film Festival on May 9th and 12th at the Lincoln Center in New York City. Good morning, Deborah. Morning. Perkin. Coming all the way from Wales, right?
That's right, yes. I live in Wales, in Cardiff, part of the United Kingdom, and only 2 hours from London.
The hometown of the great singer Shirley Bassey.
Indeed, indeed, and not far from the birthplace of Tom Jones.
Tom Jones, the Welsh singer who captivated America in the late 60s with the show with the great title of This is Tom Jones. He's still going strong. I know he was born in 1940, so that would make him about 74. He'll turn 74 in June, and the guy looks like he's a couple of decades younger than that.
He really does, yes. He's on primetime television still, judging a reality show called The Voice, and he's hugely popular with every generation.
What's your favorite Tom Jones song?
Well, it has to be The Green, Green Grass of Home.
Yeah, that's a surprising choice. That is a great song. There must be something about that that is interesting to you personally.
Well, we have so much rain in Wales that everywhere is very, very green. So I guess it makes me think of home, really, just like it makes Tom think of home.
Well, when he had his show, he used to open with It's Not Unusual. But he's had a few other hits, including his first one, I think, was the James Bond theme. He and Shirley Bassey share that as well. Thunderball.
Right.
It goes back a long way. But we're here to talk about your work. And how in the world did you end up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, with this production that's going to be in Morocco, in London, and New York City?
Well, I love Louisiana. I love New Orleans. I've been here several times, and Baton Rouge. And the real reason is I have friends here. And I was invited by a history professor, Meredith Veldman, to come and show the film to her global connections students. There's a drive to be more international at LSU and to open students' eyes up to the world around them. So I sort of fitted into that slot.
Well, we are glad you are here. And as I said, 6:30 tonight at the Russell Geoscience Building, you will have the pleasure, if you so choose, of seeing Bastards, which is about sex and single mothers in Morocco with a 14-year-old Rabha El Hamer, an illegitimate child bride who's beaten, raped, and rejected. And 10 years later, what happens?
Well, 10 years later, she starts to get her revenge on the family who abused her. I think it makes it sound very miserable the way it's described there, but actually it's an uplifting film. It tells the story of a woman who discovers, even though she's illiterate, she discovers she has rights, she can use the justice system, and she takes her former husband to court. She's been chucked out and discovers that even though she thought she was married, she's not married after all. It was a sort of traditional religious ceremony in the countryside, and it cut no ice whatsoever in the legal system. So that's how she comes to be a single mother. And the problem with the child of a single mother is it's illegitimate, a bastard. That's hence the provocative title. I'm sorry if that offends any of your listeners out there, but it certainly draws attention. And of course, it's a technical and legal term. To be a bastard is to be illegitimate. And in a society like Morocco, like any Muslim country, sex outside marriage is illegal, which comes as a huge shock, I think, to many of us living in the West. You cannot imagine a system where it's illegal, literally illegal, forbidden to have sex outside marriage. And so women like Rabha are technically criminals, and their children are social outcasts. They find it difficult to get education, to get jobs. So her struggle to make her daughter legitimate is hugely important, has vast significance. It'll make all the difference in the world to that sweet little girl.
You got unprecedented access to the justice system in Morocco. How so?
I wanted to make a film which would build a little bit of a bridge between our world and theirs. And I went to the authorities. You need permission to film, of course. And I explained that that's what I wanted to do, was to show that Morocco has a justice system which is open to people who are social outcasts like Rabha and her daughter. It took me a long time to persuade them. I mean, I think inevitably they were suspicious. They wondered if I just wanted to point the finger and say, hey, you Muslims, you know, what an awful system you have. Look how you treat women, and so on. And I really didn't want to do that. And eventually, after about a year, really, of negotiation, discussion, meetings at the Ministry of Justice, meetings at the Ministry of Communication, finally, they could see that I was sincere. I just wanted to show that Morocco is the first Muslim country in the world to give rights to single mothers.
The first. And Bastards follows Rabha's fight from the Casablanca slums to the high courts. Casablanca is a place that we're most familiar with. Speaking of 1940, I think that was the year of the film with Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. So how does that perception of Casablanca differ, if at all, from what is there today and what you encountered in producing Bastards?
Well, the film Casablanca is many people's favorites, one of their favorites, mm-hmm. isn't it? And it shows a world in wartime with many different nationalities coming together and milling around and trying to get out and escape. Casablanca is not like that today. It's full of Moroccans. It's a very lively, energetic, industrial city, a sort of throbbing heartbeat, different from the capital, which is Rabat, which is more like Washington, more clean, assured, full of government buildings and so on. But Casablanca is lively. It has nightclubs. It has lots and lots of different industries and so on. I was living amongst the single mothers I was filming. So I decided I wanted to get close to them and live in a slum, in a district where they lived. So for me, it was also a bit of a journey for me from the slums to the high courts too. I lived in a house with no bathroom, just sleeping on a mattress on the floor. My neighbours were single mothers who were very warm, very welcoming, would cook me couscous and tagines, and and I, because there was no bathroom, we would go to the hammam together to have that sort of public shower and bathhouse place, and it was great for me. I mean, for one thing, as a poor filmmaker, I was able to save money by living in a place like that.
Sure.
And also, it meant that I was living the same way as the people I was filming, and so I was able to talk to them about the troubles I had with my children, for example, or just general things. And you know, that way you get to know people as friends, and then they're more willing to trust you and take part in the film and understand what your motives are.
297-5633 if you'd like to join us in our remaining moments with Deborah Feldman. Excuse me, Deborah Feldman is next. This is Deborah Perkin, spelled the same way, by the way, the first names anyway. But Deborah Perkin is a fascinating lady from Great Britain, from Wales, who is the person responsible for a production that has gotten a lot of attention. And we're talking about one that's relatively new. You just had your world premiere this month, right?
That's right. Yes, I was in Greece last week, in fact, at Thessaloniki International Film Festival, which is one of the top documentary festivals in the world. So that was absolutely thrilling. Yes, it was a sellout, and I got wonderful reviews, excellent questions from the audience. So this screening tonight here in Baton Rouge is going to be the second screening.
Second one. So this comes right after the world premiere in Greece. And as I mentioned, next month, Deborah Perkin will be in London and in Morocco and in New York City in May for the African Film Festival at the Lincoln Center. What in the world attracted you to this story enough to do this kind of work, which I'm sure was exhaustive?
Well, I went on holiday to Morocco, and I noticed that there were a lot of women out there in the workplace, which, if you hadn't traveled in other parts of the Middle East, would not be particularly significant. But having worked in Egypt and Jordan and Turkey, Morocco was a very different sort of Muslim country, where women were carrying briefcases or working in shops, working in hotels, and just there seemed to be a much more equal relationship between men and women. So I set out to find a story which would show that reality.
Well, The Guardian has called your film moving, enraging, nail-biting, heart-rending, heartwarming, and brave. That covers a lot of emotions. I'm sure you're pleased with that review. I would be.
I'm absolutely delighted, yes. It's I mean, it's got a provocative title, Bastards, and if you talk about women's rights and Islam and illegitimacy and so on, you know, people might think it sounds rather dull and sort of difficult to watch. But in fact, it's just a very simple human story of a mother fighting for the future for her child.
Well, in this country, in the United States, right now, I think about as many kids are born out of wedlock as they are born with a mother and father who are married. So this topic may not be as controversial as it would have been 20 or 30 or 40 years ago.
No, and I think Morocco looks forward to the day when there's more tolerance towards illegitimate children over there too. I mean, I'm sure all of us wish that every child could have two parents who cared for them and brought them up in a safe and secure marriage, ideally. But where children don't have so much going for them, then they deserve the right to get an education and a job, which at least is possible today in America.
But the title of your film, that word bastard, it still has an extremely negative connotation.
Yes, it does. It does. I guess I chose it deliberately because it makes you look twice. You think, what on earth is that about? And then I hope that people realize that it's about innocent, illegitimate children. That's one meaning of the term, but also the obnoxious people who treat them with such disdain, who want them to be social outcasts.
Well, tonight at 6:30 at the Russell Geoscience Building at LSU, you can see Bastards, a film by Deborah Perkin. And if you'd like more information, you may call 225-334-1224, 225-334-1224. We thank you for joining us today and coming all the way from Wales to be right here on WRKF. Thank you, Deborah Perkin.
Thank you. It was a privilege. Thank you.
And we shall return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In just a bit, we are slated to hear from Deborah Feldman. Her book is Exodus, a memoir, and she is a compelling guest with a remarkable story to tell, and we shall hear from her, if everything goes according to plan, in short order. As mentioned by our previous guest, Deborah Perkin, Deborah, with her beautiful accent, is from Wales, which is the place where Tom Jones was hatched in 1940, and the great singer will be 74 years old come June, hard to believe. And speaking of 1940, born on this date, March 26, 1940, the Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, still the Democratic Majority Leader in the U.S. House of Representatives, and Nancy Pelosi is 74 years old today, born in Baltimore on this date. Her father's a former mayor of the great city of Baltimore. And Elizabeth Dent, a local politico, born the same day as Nancy Pelosi. Imagine that. Polar opposites politically, but born on the same day, same year, March 26, 1940. So happy birthday to Elizabeth Dent. And there was a development regarding the case that was featured briefly on this show yesterday. Steve Myers, the local landowner who has several homes in the LSU area, has gone to the Supreme Court to contest an ordinance in Baton Rouge from 1954 that prohibits people who are unrelated from living in the same house if there are more than three people who are unrelated and one of them does not own the property. So Steve Myers is battling before the Supreme Court after getting a favorable verdict from Judge Janice Clark in District Court. And his nemesis on the other side, the guy who's been his most vocal adversary, is a man who lives not far from LSU, Paul Nockan, who's been on this show, and we have endeavored to get Mr. Nockan, who was at the Supreme Court Monday, as was Mr. Myers. And as noted yesterday, Mr. Myers stated that he was offering Section 8 housing in this area near LSU, which is an area that is considered one of the nicer places in our community. But there are now Section 8 signs at properties owned by Mr. Myers on Morning Glory, Cherrydale, and Cedardale. So hopefully we will be able to make contact with Mr. Nockan soon and have him on this show and respond, because Mr. Myers was on this program yesterday. Deborah Feldman has joined us. Her book is Exodus, a memoir. Deborah is an author of renown who previously wrote the New York Times bestseller Unorthodox. Her first memoir was well received, and it has been followed with perhaps an even more provocative work. In 2009, at the age of 23, Deborah packed up her young son, their few possessions, and walked away from her roots. Good morning, Deborah Feldman.
Good morning, Jim.
Deborah, tell us about your odyssey from an Orthodox Jew to someone who basically discarded your past affiliation and began a new life.
Well, I will rephrase that. My Odyssey from a Hasidic Jew,
okay.
which is like probably five steps ahead of
okay.
Orthodox Jew.
All right.
And to just being a regular Jew, so to speak, a regular American Jew.
Well,
basically,
okay, well,
I grew up in a very insular sect located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, just across the river from Manhattan. Before that part of Brooklyn was cool or gentrified, and I never really saw the outside world or learned about the outside world. Even though I was an American citizen, I wasn't studying American history, and I was not exposed to like American popular culture. But I found the world that I grew up in very restrictive because it suppressed individuality and original thought, and I was very curious, and I wanted to learn. And I knew that the only option for me as a member of this community was to grow up, enter an arranged marriage at some point when I was 17 or 18, and then have a lot of children. And the reason for that was because the sect that I grew up in, the Satmars, it was founded after the war by a rabbi who believed that the Holocaust was a punishment for assimilation and for Zionism. And he believed that if he created this very extreme cultish community, like a recreated ghetto, in which the members lived a very fanatically regulated religious life, that he would prevent another Holocaust from happening again, because in a sense, the Holocaust had happened because God had been angry with us. And so I grew up with that over my head, and there was a lot of fear and a lot of guilt that marked my life growing up in that world. And it was only when my son was born that I realized I couldn't put him through that kind of upbringing, that I wanted more for him. I think like any mother wants more for their children. So I did leave when he was a toddler, and we started over on the outside. And when I published my first memoir, which was about my upbringing and my decision to leave, I realized that readers were really invested in my success, and they really wanted to know if I was okay and what my life was like. And that was when I started writing Exodus as a way to answer that question. And Exodus is surely provocative in some ways, although I don't think anyone will say it is as provocative as writing about a very secretive sect that no one's written about before. But Exodus is provocative in the sense that it explores something that most people who leave religion don't usually talk about, which is the enormous consequence of cutting off from everything you know and starting over with nothing. You have no sense of self. You have no place to belong. You don't know where you're going to end up, and it's tremendously alienating and scary. But we don't want to say that because we don't want to scare other people off from doing the same thing. And so in the past, when I had talked to people who left different extreme cultures, I felt like they were always under this pressure to be like, no, once you're out, it's all good. You're free. You can eat what you want. You can wear what you want. You can talk to whom you want. It's wonderful. That part is wonderful, but there are other parts that are pretty difficult.
And what are those parts?
Well, I think the hardest part about leaving was feeling like I wasn't real, or I was disappearing because I had no family. I had no community. I had no roots. I couldn't look at a particular place or a group of people and say, that's me. That's where I belong. That's my home. And this ignited a kind of panicked anxiety in me. Like, what if something happens to me? Who will care? Who will support me? Who can I count on? How do I see myself when I look in the mirror? I just didn't know who I was. Who was I going to be? Do I have a choice? What do I pick? Which one is the right fit? And it was just very scary. And I felt even more compelled to figure out this problem quickly because I was raising a child. I didn't want him to have that sense of confusion and that sense of alienation as well. The whole reason that I had left was I wanted him to feel secure and feel safe and feel like life was a positive, joyous experience. So I felt very much like I needed to get this done. I needed to figure this out. How do I fix it? But the more I tried to fix it, the more I realized that there was no easy fix. But I think in the end, what Exodus explores is this idea that maybe being alienated isn't so bad when you find other alienated people to be with you and to kind of share the experience with you and who understand you and can make you feel like at least you have some people who are with you on your journey. And I think that's what I really learned in Exodus, is not that I found my happy ending, but that I found other people who are going through the same struggle.
The guest is Deborah Feldman. As you can hear, she's a lively and articulate person who writes as well as she speaks. One of the people to endorse her work is Joan Rivers, who says Deborah boldly faces her demons, a moving and honest memoir of one young woman's capacity for reinvention. Now, you're raised in an insular and, you say, oppressive world, and then you reinvent yourself. And one of the places where you went to branch out was New Orleans. How did that go?
True. You know, I was fascinated by New Orleans for so many reasons, but I think the primary reason that I went to New Orleans first, New Orleans was literally one of the first places I traveled to independently, was because New Orleans is one of the oldest cities in this country and has a tremendous history and is very mired in its history, and its identity is very connected to that history. And in many ways, Williamsburg, the little community I grew up in, was very similar. It was very much tied to an old world identity, an old world past, you know, in such stark contrast to this very modern country. So when I went there, I felt like I got it and like the city got me. And as I wander around this absolutely heartbreakingly beautiful place, I felt very soothed. I remember feeling really just calmed and happy there. But of course, I was seeing a lot of unrest and a lot of like intense emotion around me. People seemed to be, this is the time post-Katrina, they seemed to be just like their nerves were still slightly frayed, and there was just a lot of like emotion in the city, and I kind of felt it, and I felt the darkness, and that felt more comfortable to me. It felt real. And as I wandered around New Orleans, I met various interesting people. I ran into a young man who had grown up in Brownsville, Brooklyn, who had just gotten out of prison and was looking for a job as a line cook in New Orleans. And he, I remember he said to me, and I said this in the book, he's like, "You a Caucasian woman, and you're talking to me." And I said, "Caucasian? What's that? I'm not Caucasian. I'm Jewish." I was so surprised that he looked at me and saw me as white. And it was really made me conscious of the racial divides that I had never been exposed to growing up. I grew up in an all Satmar world, all Jewish.
And when you say Williamsburg, we're talking about Williamsburg in Brooklyn, not Williamsburg, Virginia.
Virginia, correct.
Okay. How many Hasidic correct. Jews are there in the area where you grew up?
About 100,000.
100,000. And of course, many of the people there are comfortable, and they would not go on the voyage you did. Do you have any complaints about others who make choices different than yours?
No, I actually think that there's a reason why I, in particular, felt out of place there. And one of that is sociological. Like, I had parents who divorced when I was very young, and it was quite a scandal because the Satmar community values the family unit above all else, and people just don't get divorced. And if they do, they, you know, they remarry right away and just keep having babies. And, you know, my mom divorced my dad, left the community. She came out as gay. I mean, all that is just like, it's just not done. It doesn't happen. And it created this scandal that stained the reputation of my entire family, and particularly my reputation. So ever since I can remember as a child, I was aware that I was different, that I reminded everyone in my family of something they would rather not be reminded of, that they resented me for it, that my peers saw me as an outcast, as someone who would never quite fit in. And so already I think that was the beginning. That was me already feeling rejected, feeling pushed out, feeling like I couldn't find acceptance and joy and belonging. And so where did I go for that? I went to books. I started sneaking out to the public libraries in Brooklyn and reading in secret, even though I wasn't allowed to, because the heroines in the books, the characters, became my friends. They became the people who accepted me. And when I read particularly those classic children's books, James and the Giant Peach, Royal Dolls, Matilda, I thought, oh, these are my people. Here you have children who are misunderstood, who are rejected, but the story says they're special. So I thought, if they're special, I started to believe I was special. And I think what's really interesting is I've met a lot of people who've survived difficult childhoods, and they all say that they have that in common, where we create narratives of specialness in order to survive, in order to kind of keep going and believe in yourself, even when everyone else doesn't. And I think what's really interesting about what happens afterwards in Exodus, a lot of the process of leaving and kind of building my own life was letting go of that narrative. because the narrative of specialness is actually an intense burden. It puts this pressure on you to be perfect, to be better, to whip up that happy ending ASAP, but you can't. And in the beginning, I put a lot of pressure on myself to be happy. I was like, why aren't you happy yet? Why isn't your life perfect yet? You're special. You're like Matilda. You have to, like, just make it work fast. And then I realized, no, I'm not special. I'm human. You know, what I went through was human, and it's something I have to deal with slowly, and it's something I have to come to terms with in my own time, and that's fine. That's okay. I don't have to be special.
Well, you enrolled at Sarah Lawrence, right, when you were 20
Correct.
Years old. Was that the first big step?
Absolutely. I would say that was the first step, because that was the first glimpse I got of the outside world. And even though my whole life I had been told that the outside world was dangerous, that other people would hate me because I was Jewish, that they would never accept me, that my only true home was with Hasidic Jews, I found acceptance there almost immediately. And it was so shocking. It was just not what I expected. And it provided me with the very beginnings of community that I really craved.
Well, you're no longer Hasidic, no longer Orthodox, but you certainly claim to be a person who is Jewish. Do you view being Jewish as an ethnic distinction, Deborah, or as a religious affiliation, or both?
I definitely see it as ethnic. The moment that I realized that I was unequivocally and irreversibly Jewish was actually quite recently. It was last fall. I mentioned in the book that I had a love affair with a German man who was descended from Nazi party members. And it was something I pursued, I think, at the time because I really wanted to rid myself of this belief that there was a whole people out there that hated me, that were evil, the belief that I had grown up with. I wanted to kind of move past the hurt and the damage of the Holocaust stories that I had felt very overshadowed by. And so I entered this relationship in order to do that sort of classic thing that we do through love, which is to find the humanity in other people and to make ourselves more human in the process. And I thought that I would make it work in that this was sort of way of moving past what I thought I could never escape. And then last fall, this man was visiting me, and he asked me for a book to read on the plane ride home. He's like, what's your favorite book? Who's your favorite writer? And I handed him a collection of short stories by Nathan Englander. It was called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. And it's not about the Holocaust at all. It's just one of the title stories. But I gave that book to him because Nathan Englander truly is my favorite American writer, and I wanted to share that with him. And when we Skyped a few days later, and I asked him, what did you think of the book? Did you like it? And he said, I read two stories, and then I stopped, and I'm not going to finish it. I said, why? Don't you like his writing? He says, no, it's not that he's not a good writer. He's definitely a great writer. But to be honest with you, he said, it's a bit Jew overload for me. And I said, honey, if Nathan Englander is Jew overload for you, why are you dating me? And it was just that moment that I realized that I couldn't minimize or compromise my Jewishness, not even a drop, to make it more convenient for him who didn't want to deal with it all the time because it brought up baggage. It brought up history that he didn't want to face. And I thought, no, my Jewishness is central. It's the forefront of who I am, and I just cannot diminish it even a tiny amount. And that was just when it really kind of hit home for me. Yes, I really am. I am 120% Jewish, and no one can take that away.
Well, the book is Exodus, a memoir by Deborah Feldman. We thank you for joining us today, and congrats on the most profound and compelling book. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing today, and our guest at this time is Susan Schillinglaw. She is a professor of English at San Jose State University and a scholar in residence at the National Steinbeck Center in California. And for 18 years, she was director of the Center for Steinbeck Studies at San Jose State University. And her book, appropriately, is called On Reading the Grapes of Wrath, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of 1939 that was made into a film of great significance a year later, in 1940. and Susan Schillinglaw. All these years later, The Grapes of Wrath still packs a punch. It was John Steinbeck who said there are five layers in this book. A reader will find as many as he can, and he won't find more than he has in himself. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Why has this book stood the test of time?
Well, I think there are several reasons. It's beautiful prose, first of all. To reread The Grapes of Wrath is to fall in love with Steinbeck again, I think, because it's a stately, majestic prose. And then the dialogue, he prided himself on dialogue and has a really pure, wonderful dialogue. But more than that, I think it's really poignant and relevant today, because this book is about dispossession, about people having to leave one place and move to another, being uprooted. It's the great American novel of dispossession and of what it feels like to be on the margins, to have to work for a living, work with your hands, be hungry, be homeless. And I think the great gap between haves and have-nots is one of the things that this book explores. It's about the power of banks and corporations to, you know, kick people off the land or not help when there's a lot of there's great need, as is true of the Joads in California. And it's about ecological cataclysmic events, so it's about ecology as well, Dust Bowl, things that we can't control that create these great economic and social upheavals. So it really seems, I think, in many ways, a very relevant book for today.
Well, the book is about America and Route 66 and the Depression, and John Steinbeck captured that time, that place, as well as anybody ever has. The book is read in high school and college literature classes. It was made into a movie that is perhaps even better known than the book. Did all this contribute to the mythology that surrounds The Grapes of Wrath?
Well, certainly. I think that it's hard to underestimate, I think, the power of the book when it was first published in 1939, because everybody in America was reading The Grapes of Wrath, and I don't know how many books we can say have that same punch today. It was much discussed in newspapers, and Eleanor Roosevelt came to Steinbeck's defense because he was accused of lying, that certainly people didn't live in such circumstances. Oklahoma said the novel gave the state a bad name. Californians, many Californians said, oh, it makes our state look greedy and selfish. So everybody was discussing The Grapes of Wrath, both the beauty of the language and the power of the book, as well as, you know, the vision of poverty that the book exposed. And the film just, you know, enhanced that. So the fact that there was film and book almost at the same time, the film came out in January 1940, the book in April 1939, it was just a very topical and timely book. And I think that that sort of explosive moment has really never dimmed, because readers keep coming back to this book as many and many levels of society saying, this is my experience. This is what it feels like to be marginalized, to be poor, to have to work. So the book keeps being relevant and necessary to reread, I think.
Well, Steinbeck was already a celebrated author when The Grapes of Wrath was published, and he didn't stop there. He kept going. He had other works that were also fantastic. And what about this particular work that caused it to soar above all the others? And as I stated, a man who wrote work that compares favorably with another great author of his time, Ernest Hemingway.
Well, I think that the book that he wrote right before he started the research on The Grapes of Wrath was Of Mice and Men. And I think that book is still read in most high schools and junior high schools across the country, because it's about friendship, it's about the American dream, it's the power of the dream, it's what will you do for a friend, it's about loneliness and what cuts against loneliness, that great power of friends. So he was very much known for that book. And for Tortilla Flat, which had been a great success in 1935. And, of course, he went on to write a book, East of Eden, another epic book, He won the Nobel Prize in 1962, and the occasion for that was Winter of Our Discontent, although, of course, Grapes of Wrath was really what he was mostly being recognized for. But I think that Grapes of Wrath rises to the top because it's probably his best book, and it's so, I think, urgent and compelling. It's really about, as I say, the levels kind of lifted out of the 30s in his sense that he was writing a book about one time, certainly the 1930s, but also the American experience of westward movement and starting over, and California is the dream state. It kind of taps into that story. There's a biblical level in the book, the story of Exodus, because he has Preacher as one of his central characters, Jim Casey, and so you see that kind of biblical level informing the book. So he really takes it from one time and place and makes it about many eras.
297-5633, our number, as we visit with Susan Schillinglaw. Dr. Schillinglaw's book is On Reading, The Grapes of Wrath. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Susan.
Good morning. Have you had a chance to visit the Steinbeck Museum in his California hometown, where it tracks his life through his works, you know, from Cup of Gold to Travels with Charlie, including the auto itself?
Yes, I many times in Salinas, California. I'm the scholar in residence at the National Steinbeck Center, and I love the place. It's a great place to visit as a resident or as a visitor to California.
It's great, yeah.
Thank you, Dan. Good to talk with you. What about his place among the other literary greats of his time and of all time? Do you think
you mentioned Hemingway, and I think that, you know, Steinbeck was very much aware of Hemingway, and Hemingway was very much aware of Steinbeck and the kind of writing they were doing. In some ways, they were doing the same thing, which was try to strip prose of excess adjectives and ornamentation and modifiers and just write about the thing itself. Hemingway probably seems more innovative than Steinbeck, but both were wanting to simplify and clarify American prose. Steinbeck thought Hemingway was a great writer, but I think Steinbeck's a great writer too. Hemingway was a little jealous of Steinbeck's popularity, especially a book like The Pearl. One Hemingway scholar thinks that Hemingway wrote Old Man and the Sea to show that he could write a better sea story than Steinbeck had. So there was a kind of, you know, race to the top. I think Steinbeck's prose is very different from something like someone like William Faulkner's, who's writing this great sort of stream of consciousness prose. But they were similar in a sense of love of place and trying to evoke a place. For Faulkner, Mississippi, and for Steinbeck, California. We think of Steinbeck country as Monterey County and, of course, beyond into the Central Valley, but how beautifully Steinbeck evokes the sense of place and how important it is to understand humans and where they live and how where we live determines who we are. So he has this ecological vision about seeing people not as controlling an environment but as living in place. And I think that's another great contribution he made to American letters. And Willa Cather was his favorite writer, another writer who's very much tied to place.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. One of my favorite writers. Personally, I think that he embodies the cycle of boom and bust that the economies go through. And I think that's a cycle that we don't look at. It's been around for quite a long time. I would ask you that just to how that compares to today, you know, how that applies to those stories of the common man. And also I would recommend B. Traven as an author that people could look at for stories about the working man.
Susan?
Well, that's very interesting. I don't know that writer, but I will certainly look it up. I think that Steinbeck asks us to look at people we don't ordinarily see and hear their voices. One thing Steinbeck's great at is dialogue, and he really captures the voice of working people. I mean, I love the relationship between Rosa Sharon and Ma, and here's one of the things that Ma tells Rosa Sharon. She says, "Rosa Sharon, you stop picking at yourself." because Rosa Sharon's whining about not feeling well. You're just a-teasing yourself up to cry. I don't know what's come at you. Our folks ain't never did that. They took what come to them dry-eyed. Now, in that little speech, there's such a pride in one's heritage and where one's people, and Ma's trying to teach Rosa Sharon to see herself as really an Okie and be proud. And I think that's one of the things, you know, the book, the clear notes in the book that it strikes, pride in one's legacy and one's people.
Well, we thank you for joining us. It's a compelling book, and if you love John Steinbeck, you'll love On Reading the Grapes of Wrath from Dr. Susan Schillinglaw. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Our pleasure. 297-5633 is your number, and as promised, we have made contact with Paul Nockan, who's on the other side of this epic court fight in Louisiana regarding the definition of family as it relates to where people live in Baton Rouge. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Fine. Well, we talked with Mr. Myers yesterday on this show. What's your take on what happened at the Supreme Court Monday?
Well, we're waiting for the decision, and of course, we hope that the Supreme Court justices want to uphold what the United States Supreme Court has upheld in similar cases. And, of course, Mr. Myers has no respect for A1 single-family subdivisions. I believe it's only his pocketbook he cares about. And you alerted me about this Section 8 signs in front of some of the houses that he has for rent. And I met with the housing authorities this morning, got all the rules, regulations. Students by the federal government cannot receive funds under Section 8. Only one student per house, provided he is not still dependent on his parents, can rent. So I got all the information, copies of that from a very nice lady at the housing department. And I'm getting ready to have people to really look into that and see, you know, what options there are there. But, you know, we just want to protect our A1 single-family subdivisions from people that, you know, concrete front yards.
All right, well,
have no
right on your street, he has a sign that's at one of his homes that says Section 8 welcome for lease and then his phone number. Or a phone number that would
right.
be involved. Their homes on
Cedardale
and Cherrydale that have this sign. He could rent to people other than students, though, couldn't he?
Yes, he could, but there are, you know, real sanctions and restrictions and qualifications that have to be looked at.
Well, Section 8 is usually associated with people who don't have a lot of means, and these are, of course, this is a very nice neighborhood we're talking about.
Right.
You're not concerned about him renting to people who might not have as many means as you, are you, Paul?
Well, we'd like to have everybody in the neighborhood like everybody else. You know, we don't want a bunch of people in there that... of real poor means.
Why not?
In there.
Why not? It might enhance the neighborhood to have some people with a different life perspective.
Well, you know, that depends on who goes in there. You know, you see all the trouble we have in Baton Rouge and other cities with people that don't have much, and we hate to see, you know, something happen.
So you're saying poor people are more dangerous than people who are affluent?
Well, look what's in the newspaper all day, every day, and see who is being charged with different things, and that should answer your question.
Poor people?
We don't have a whole bunch of professional people that are being arrested for this, that, and the other. And, you know, Jim, that's, you know, kind of beside the point there. We're just wanting to see what is going to develop. I'm getting ready to turn over all of this information that I got from the housing authority to some people at the city and some attorneys who live in the area and, you know, just study it more. And we do know that, you know, Myers has numbers of students living in some of these houses. And, of course, if they can't get housing, it's going to eliminate, you know, having four, five, six cars in a front yard and make the subdivisions look a whole lot nicer.
Well, these signs, are you upset about them? Does that enrage you or upset you at all?
Well, you know, it just is another thing that he's doing to disgrace and to make a neighborhood not nice. And I don't know. I want to check the street he lives on and see if he's put some of the signs up on the places he owns on his street for Section 8 rental.
So you don't like Section 8 coming to Morning Glory and Cedardale and Cherrydale?
Everybody that I've talked to in the neighborhood isn't particularly fond of it.
Well, Paul, we thank you for joining us on short notice, and this is an interesting, fascinating case, and soon the Supreme Court will rule, and we look forward to visiting with you and Steve Myers when that happens.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Paul.
We appreciate what you do also.
Thank you, Paul Nockan. And we shall return tomorrow. Until then, for Frank Barnett and Bianca Webb, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.